The Dedham girls' horses, forgotten even by Nettie, starved and died in their stables. This December, people stayed in their houses more than they were used to, and tempers wore thin, some broke. Philip Nagler, one of the new Milburnites, went inside and beat up his wife after his snowblower broke down on his driveway. Ronnie Byram, a nephew of Harlan Bouts's, home on leave from the Marines, objected to the harmless remarks of a man standing beside him in a bar and broke his nose. He would have broken his jaw if two of Ronnie's old high school buddies had not pinned his arms back. Two 16-year-old boys named Billy Byram, Ronnie's brother, and Anthony Spacemaker Ortega concussed a younger boy who insisted on talking through the 8:25 showing of Night of the Living Dead at Clark Mulligan's Rialto Theater. All over Milburn, couples locked together in their houses quarreled about their babies, their money, their television programs. A deacon of the Holy Ghost Presbyterian Church, the same church of which Lewis's father had once been pastor, locked himself in the unheated building one night 2 weeks before Christmas and wept and cursed and prayed all night because he thought he was going crazy. He thought he had seen the naked boy Jesus standing on a snowdrift outside the church windows, begging him to come out. At the Bay Tree Market, Rhoda Flagler pulled a clump of blonde hair out of the scalp of Bitsy Underwood because Bitsy had challenged her right to the last 3 cans of pureed pumpkin. With the trucks unable to make deliveries, all the stocks were getting low. In the Hollow, an unemployed bartender named Jim Blazek knifed and killed a mulatto short order cook named Washington D'Souza because a tall man with a shaven head who dressed like a sailor had told Blazek that D'Souza was messing around with his wife. During the 62 days from the 1st of December to the 31st of January, these 10 citizens of Milburn died of natural causes. George Fleischner, 62, heart attack. Whitey Rudd, 70, malnutrition. Gabriel Fish, 58, exposure. Omar Norris, 61, exposure following concussion. Marion Lesage, 73, stroke. Ethel Burt, 76, Hodgkin's disease. Dylan Griffin, 5 months, hypothermia. Harlan Bouts, 55, heart attack. Nettie Dedham, 81, stroke. Penny Drager, 18, shock. Most of these died during the worst of the snows, and their bodies, along with those of Washington D'Souza and several others, had to be kept stacked and covered with sheets in one of the unused utility cells in Walter Hardesty's tiny jail. The wagon from the morgue in the county seat couldn't make it into Milburn. The town closed in on itself, and even the ice skating on the river died out. At first, the skating went as it always had. Every hour of daylight saw 20 or 30 high school students, mixed in with kids from elementary school, dashing back and forth playing crack the whip and skating backward, a print by Courier and Ives. But if the high school juniors and seniors who swept off the ice never noticed the death of 3 old women and 4 old men and did not much mourn the passing of their dentist, another loss hit them like a slap in the face as soon as they glided out onto the frozen river. Jim Hardy had been the best skater Milburn had ever seen, and he and Penny Drager had worked out tandem routines which looked to their contemporaries as good as anything you saw in the Olympics. Peter Barnes had been nearly as good, but he refused to come skating this year. Even when the weather paused, Peter stayed at home. But Jim was the one they missed. Even when he showed up in the morning with bloodshot eyes and a stubble on his cheeks, he had enlivened them all. You couldn't watch him without trying to skate a little better yourself. Now, even Penny Drager did not show up. Like Peter Barnes, she had drifted away into privacy. Soon, most of the other skaters did the same. Every day, more snow had to be shoveled off the river, and some of the boys doing the shoveling thought that Jim Hardy was not in New York after all. They had a feeling that something had happened to Jim, something they didn't want to think about too much. Days before it was proven, they knew that Jim Hardy was dead. One day during his afternoon break, Bill Webb picked up his battered old hockey skates from his locker behind the restaurant and walked over to the river and looked dully at the two untouched feet of fresh snow blanketing it. For this winter, the skating was dead too. Clark Mulligan never bothered to book the new Disney film he always brought in at Christmas, but ran horror movies all through the season. Some nights he had 7 or 8 customers, some nights only 2 or 3. Other nights, he started up the first reel of Night of the Living Dead and knew he was showing it only to himself. Saturday's matinee usually brought out 10 or 15 kids who had already seen the movie but couldn't think of anything else to do. He began letting them in for free. Every day he lost a little more money, but at least the Rialto got him away from home. As long as the power lines stayed up, he could keep warm and busy, and that was all he wanted. One night, he walked down from the booth to see if anybody had bothered to sneak in through the fire door, and saw Penny Drager sitting beside a wolf-faced man wearing sunglasses. Clark hurried back up to his projection booth, but he was sure the man had grinned at him before he could turn away. He didn't know why, but that frightened him badly. For the first time in most of their lives, Milburn people saw the weather as malevolent, a hostile force that would kill them if they let it. Unless you got up on your roof and knocked off the snow, the rafter beams would crack and buckle under its weight, and in 10 minutes your house would be a frigid, ruined shell, uninhabitable until spring. The wind chill factor sometimes brought the temperature down to 60 below, and if you stayed outside for much longer than it took to run from your car to your house, you could hear the wind chuckling in your inner ear, knowing that it had you where it wanted you. That was one enemy, the worst they knew. But after Walt Hardesty and one of his deputies identified the bodies of Jim Hardy and Christina Barnes, and word got around about the condition of their bodies, Milburn people drew their drapes and switched on their television instead of going out to their neighbor's party and wondered if it was a bear, after all, that killed handsome Louis Benedict. And when, like Millie Sheehan, they saw that a line of snow had worked in around the storm window and lay like a taunt on the sill, they began to think about what else might get in. So they, like the town, closed in, shut down, thought about survival. A few remembered Elmer Scales standing in front of the statue, waving his shotgun and ranting about Martians. Only 4 people knew the identity of an enemy more hostile than the murderous weather. Sentimental Journey 2.
"I see on the news that it's worse in Buffalo," Ricky said, talking more for its own sake than because he thought the other two would be interested. Sears was driving his Lincoln in extremely Sears-like style, all the way to Edward's house where they had picked up Don, and now back to the west side of town. He had hunched over the wheel and proceeded at 15 miles an hour. He blew his horn at every intersection, warning all comers that he did not intend to stop.
"Stop babbling, Ricky," he said, and blasted his horn and rolled across Wheat Road to the north end of the square.
"You didn't have to blow the horn. That was a green light," Ricky pointed out.
"Humph, everybody else is going too fast to stop."
Don, in the back seat,
held his breath, and prayed that the traffic lights on the other end of the square would turn green before Sears reached them. When they passed the steps to the hotel, he saw the lights facing Main Street flash to amber. The lights switched to green just as Sears put the entire palm of his hand down on the button and floated the long car like a galleon onto Main Street. Even with the headlights on, the only objects truly visible were traffic lights and the red and green pinpoints of illumination on the Christmas tree. All else dissolved in swirling white. The few approaching cars appeared first as streamers of yellow light, then as shapeless forms like large animals. Don could see their colors only when they were immediately alongside, a proximity Sears acknowledged with another imperious blast of the Lincoln's horn. "What do we do when we get there, if we ever do?" Sears asked.
"Just have a look around. It might help."
Ricky looked at him in a way that was as good as speaking, and Don added, "No, I don't think she'll be there. Or Gregory."
"Did you bring a weapon?"
"I don't own a weapon. Did you?" Ricky nodded. He held up a kitchen knife.
"Foolish, I know, but..."
Don did not think it was foolish. For a moment he wished that he too had a knife, if not a flamethrower and a grenade.
"Just out of curiosity, what are you thinking about at this moment?" Sears asked.
"Me?" Don asked. The car began to drift slowly sideways, and Sears turned the wheel very slightly to correct it.
"Yes.
I was just remembering something that used to happen back when I was a prep school student in the Midwest. When we had to choose our colleges, the staff would give us talks about the East. The East, where they wanted us to go. It was simple snobbery. And my school was very old-fashioned in that way. But the school would look better if a big proportion of its seniors went on to Harvard or Princeton or Cornell, or even a state university on the East Coast. Everybody pronounced the word the way a Muslim must pronounce the word Mecca. And that's where we are now."
"Did you go East?" Ricky asked. "I don't know if Edward ever mentioned it."
"No, I went to California, where they believed in mysticism. They didn't drown witches, they gave them talk shows."
"Omar never got around to plowing Montgomery Street," Sears said.
Don, surprised, turned to his window and saw that while he had talked, they had reached the end of Anamostin Street. Sears was right. On Maple, where they were, hard-packed snow about 2 inches deep showed the treads and deep grooves of Omar Norris's plow. It was like a white riverbed cut through high white banks. On Montgomery, the snow lay 4 feet deep. Already filling up with fresh snowfall, deep indentations down the middle of the road indicated where two or three people had fought through to Maple. Sears turned off the ignition, leaving the parking lights on.
"If we're going through with this, I see no point in waiting."
The three men stepped out onto the glassy surface of Maple Street. Sears turned up the fur collar of his coat and sighed.
"To think I once balked at stepping into the 2 or 3 inches of snow on our Virgil's field."
"I hate the thought of going into that house again," Ricky said.
All three could see the house through the swirls of falling snow.
"I've never actually broken into a house before," Sears said. "How do you propose to do it?"
"Peter said that Jim Hardy broke a pane of glass in the back door. All we have to do is reach in and turn the knob."
"And if we see them, if they are waiting for us?"
"Then we try to put up a better fight than Sergeant York," Ricky said, "I suppose. Do you remember Sergeant York, Don?"
"No," Don said. "I don't even remember Audie Murphy. Let's go." He stepped into the drift left by the plow.
His forehead was already so cold it felt like a metal plate grafted onto his skin. When he and Ricky were both on top of the drift, they reached down to Sears, who stood with his arms extended like a small boy, and pulled him forward. Sears lumbered forward and up like a whale taking a reef, and then all three men stepped from the top of the drift into the deep snow on Montgomery Street. The snow came up past their knees. Dunn realized that the two old men were waiting for him to begin, so he turned around and began to move up the street toward Anna Mostyn's house, doing his best to step in the deep depressions made by an earlier walker. Ricky followed, using the same prints. Sears, off to the side and stumping through unbroken snow, came last. The bottom of his black coat swept along after him like a train. It took them 20 minutes to reach the house. When all three were standing in front of the building, Don again saw the two older men looking at him and knew that they would not move until he made them do it. "At least it'll be warmer inside," he said.
"I just hate the thought of going in there again," Ricky said, not very loudly.
"So you said," Sears reminded him. "Around the back, Don?"
"Around the back."
Once again he led the way. He could hear Ricky sneezing behind him as each of them plowed on through snow nearly waist high. Like Jim Hardy and Peter Barnes, they stopped at the side window and looked in, saw only a dark, empty chamber.
"Deserted," Don said,
and continued around to the rear of the house. He found the window Jim Hardy had broken, and just as Ricky joined him on the back step, reached in and turned the handle of the kitchen door. Breathing heavily, Sears joined them.
"Let's get in out of the snow," Sears said. "I'm freezing."
It was one of the bravest statements Don had ever heard, and he had to answer it with a similar courage. He pushed the door and stepped into the kitchen of Anna Mostyn's house. Sears and Ricky came in close behind him.
"Well, here we are," Ricky said. "To think it's been 50 years, or near enough. Should we split up?"
"Afraid to, Ricky," Sears said, impatiently brushing snow off his coat. "I'll believe in these ghouls when I see them. You and Don can look at the rooms upstairs and on the landings. I'll do this floor in the basement." And if the earlier statement had been an act of courage, this, Don knew, was a demonstration of friendship. None of them wanted to be alone in the house.
"All right," he said. "I'll be surprised if we find anything, too. We might as well start."
Sears led as they left the kitchen and went into the hall.
"Go on," he said, commanded. "I'll be fine. This way we'll save time, and the sooner we get it over with, the better."
Don was already on the stairs, but Ricky had turned questioningly back to Sears.
"If you see anything, give a shout."
3. Don and Ricky Hawthorne were alone on the staircase.
"It didn't used to be like this," Ricky said. "Not at all, you know. This place used to be so beautiful then. The rooms downstairs and her room up there on the landing, just beautiful."
"So were Alma's rooms," Don said. He and Ricky could hear Sears's footsteps on the boards of the lower room. The sound brought a new awareness flooding across Ricky's features.
"What is it?"
"Nothing."
"Tell me. Your whole face changed." Ricky blushed.
"This is the house we dream about. Our nightmares are set here. Bare boards, empty rooms, the sound of something moving around, like Sears just now down below. That's how the nightmare begins. When we dream it, we're in a bedroom. Up there."
He pointed up the staircase.
"On the top floor."
He went up a few steps.
"I have to go up there. I have to see the room. It might help to stop the nightmare.
I'll go with you, Don said. When they reached the landing, Ricky stopped short.
Didn't Peter tell you this was where?
He pointed to a dark smear down the side of the wall.
Where Bate killed Jim Hardy.
Don swallowed involuntarily.
Let's not stay here any longer than we have to.
I don't mind splitting up, Ricky hastily said. Why don't you take Eva's old bedroom and the rooms on the next landing, and I'll prowl around on the top floor? It'll go faster that way. If I find anything, I'll call for you. I want to get out of here, too. I can't stand being here.
Don nodded, agreeing with him wholeheartedly. Ricky continued up the stairs, and Don climbed to a half-landing and swung open the door to Eva Galley's bedroom.
Bare, desolate. Then the noises of an invisible crowd, hushing feet and whispers, rattling papers. Don hesitantly took a step deeper into the empty room, and the door crashed shut behind him.
Ricky, he said, and knew that his voice was no louder than the whispers behind him. The dim light guttered, and from the moment he could no longer see the walls, Don felt that he was in a much larger room. The walls and ceiling had flown out, expanded, leaving him in a psychic space he did not know how to leave. A cold mouth pressed against his ear and said, or thought, the word, "Welcome." He swung around to the source of the sound, thinking belatedly that the mouth, like the greeting, had been only a thought. His fist met air. As if playfully to punish him, someone tripped him, and he landed painfully on hands and knees. A carpet met his hands. This gradually took on color, dark blue, and he realized that he could see again. Don lifted his head and saw a white-haired man in a blazer, the color of the carpet, and gray slacks above mirror-polished black loafers standing before him. The blazer covered a prosperous little paunch. The man smiled down in a rueful fashion and offered him a hand. Behind him, other men moved. Don knew immediately who he was.
"Have a little accident, Don," he said. "Here, take my hand."
He pulled him upright.
"Glad you could make it. We were waiting for you."
"I know who you are," Don said. "Your name is Robert Mobley."
"Why, of course. And you read my memoir, though I wish you could have been more complimentary about the writing. No matter, my boy, no matter. No apologies necessary."
Don was looking around the room, which had a long, slightly pitched floor ending at a small stage. There were no doors he could see, and the pale walls rose almost to cathedral height. Way up, tiny lights flashed and winked. Under this false sky, 50 or 60 people milled about as if at a party. At the top end of the room, where a small bar had been set up, Don saw Louis Benedict, wearing a khaki jacket and carrying a bottle of beer. He was talking to a gray-suited old man with sunken cheeks and bright, tragic eyes, who must have been Dr. John Jaffrey.
"Your son must be here," Don guessed.
"Shall be? Indeed he is. There's Shelby over there."
He nodded in the direction of a boy in his late teens who smiled back at them.
"We're all here for the entertainment, which promises to be very exciting."
"And you were waiting for me."
"Well, Donald, without you, none of this could have been arranged."
"I'm getting out of here."
"Leave? Why, my boy, you can't. You'll have to let the show roll on, I'm afraid. You've already noticed there are no doors here. And there's nothing to fear. Nothing here can harm you. It's all entertainment, you see. Mere shadows and pictures, only that."
"Go to hell," Don said. "This is some kind of charade she set up."
"Amy Monckton, you mean? Why, she's only a child.
You can't imagine. But Don was already walking away toward the side of the theater.
It's no good, dear boy, Mobley called after him. You're going to have to stay with us until it's over.
Don pressed his hands against the wall, aware that everybody in the room was looking at him. The wall was covered in a pale, felt-like material, but beneath the fabric was something cold and hard as iron. He looked up to the winking dots of light. Then he pounded the wall with the flat of his hand. No depression, no hidden door, nothing but a flat, sealed surface. The invisible lights dimmed, as did the imitation stars. Two men took him, one holding an arm, the other a shoulder. They forcibly turned him to face the stage, on which a single spotlight shone. In the middle of the spot stood a placard board. The first placard read, Rabbitfoot DePeyser Productions takes pride in presenting. A hand dipped into the light and removed the sign. A short word from our sponsor. The curtain went up to reveal a television set. Don thought it was blank until he noticed details on the white screen. The red brick of a chimney, the snow, which was real snow. Then the picture jumped into life for him. It was a high-angled shot of Montgomery Street, taken from over the roof of Anna Mostyn's house. Immediately after he recognized the setting, the characters appeared. He, Sears James, and Ricky Hawthorne, struggling up the middle of Montgomery Street. He and Ricky looking at the house for as long as they were in frame. Sears looking down, as if consciously to give contrast to the shot. There was no sound, and Don could not remember what they had said to each other before marching toward the house. Three faces in fast-cut close-ups. Their eyebrows, crusted with white, they looked like soldiers conducting a mopping-up operation in some Arctic war. Ricky's tired face was obviously that of a man with a bad cold. He was suffering. It was much clearer to Don now than it had been outside the house. Then, a shot of his reaching in through the broken window. An exterior camera followed the three men into the house, tracking them through the kitchen and into the dark hallway. More unheard conversation. A third camera picked up Don and Ricky climbing the stairs, Ricky pointing to the bloodstain. On Ricky's civilized face was the expression of pain he had seen. They parted, and the camera left Don just as he pushed at the door to Anna Mostyn's bedroom. Don uneasily watched the camera following Ricky up the stairs. A jump cut to the end of an empty corridor. Ricky, seen in silhouette, pausing on a landing, then going up to the top floor. Another jump cut. Ricky entering the top floor, trying the first door and entering a room. Inside the room now. Ricky came through the door with the camera watching him like a hidden assailant. Ricky breathing heavily, looking at the room with open mouth and widening eyes. The room of the nightmare, then, as he had guessed. The camera began to creep toward him. Then it, or the creature it represented, sprang. Two hands gripped Ricky's neck, choking him. Ricky fought, pushing at his murderer's wrists, but was too weak to break his grip. The hands tightened, and Ricky began to die. Not cleanly, as on the television programs this commercial imitated, but messily, with streaming eyes and bleeding tongue. His back arched helplessly. Fluids streamed from his eyes and nose. His face began to turn black. Peter Barnes said they can make you see things, Don thought. That's all they're doing now. Ricky Hawthorne died in front of him, in color, on a 26-inch screen. 4. Ricky forced himself to open the door of the first bedroom on the top floor of the house. He wished he were home with Stella. She had been very shaken by Lewis's death, though she knew nothing of Peter Barnes's story. Maybe this is where it ends, he thought, and went through into the bedroom, and forced himself to stand still. Even the breath in his body wanted to flee. It was the room of the dream, and every atom of it seemed pervaded with the Chowder Society's misery. Here they had each sweated and gone cold with fear. On this bed, now with a single gray blanket thrown over the bare mattress, each had struggled helplessly to move. In the prison of that wretched bed, they had waited for life to end. The room stood only for death. It was an emblem of death, and its bare, cold bleakness was its image. He remembered that Sears was, or soon would be, in the cellar. But there was no cellar beast, just as there was no sweating Ricky Hawthorne pinned to the bed. He turned around slowly, taking in all of the room. On a side wall hung the only anomaly, a small mirror. "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the scaredest of them all?"
"Not I," said the little red hen.
Ricky went around the bed to approach the mirror. Set opposite the window, it reflected a white section of sky. Tiny flakes of snow drifted across its surface and disappeared at the bottom of the frame. When Ricky got closer to the mirror, a whisper of breeze slid against his face. He bent forward, and a sparse handful of snowflakes spun out to touch his cheek. He made the mistake of looking directly into what he now confusedly thought must be a small window open directly to the weather. A face appeared before him, a face he knew, wild and lost. Then he glimpsed Elmer Scales moving clumsily through the snow, carrying a shotgun. Like the first apparition, the farmer was splashed with blood. The jug-eared face had starved down to skin-covered bone, but in Scales's fierce gauntness was something which forced Ricky to think.
He saw something beautiful. Elmer always wanted to look at something beautiful.
This bubbled to the surface of Ricky's mind and broke. Elmer was screaming into the blaring storm, lifting his gun and shooting at a small form, flipping it over in a spray of blood. Then Elmer and his target blew away, and he was looking at Lewis's back. A naked woman stood in front of Lewis, soundlessly mouthing words. "Scripture," he read, then, "See scripture in the pond, Lewis?" The woman was not living, nor was she beautiful. But Ricky saw the lineaments of returned desire in the dead face and knew he was looking at Lewis's wife. He tried to back away and escape the vision, but found he could not move. Just when the woman closed on Lewis, both she and he melting into unrecognizable forms, Ricky saw Peter Barnes crouching in a corner of the storm. No, in a building. Some building he knew but could not recognize. Some long, familiar corner, a worn carpet, a curved tan wall with a dim light in a sconce. A man like a wolf was bending over terrified Peter Barnes, grinning at him with white, prominent teeth. This time there was no melting, merciful snowfall to hide the dreadful thing from Ricky Hawthorne. The creature leaned over cowering Peter Barnes, picked him up, and like a lion killing a gazelle, broke his back. Lion-like, it bit into the boy's skin and began to eat. 5. Sears James had inspected the front rooms of the house and found nothing. And nothing, he thought, was what they were most likely to find in all the rest of the house. One empty suitcase scarcely justified going even a foot beyond one's door in weather like this. He came back into the hall, heard Don walking aimlessly about in a bedroom at the top of the stairs, and made a quick check through the kitchen. Wet footprints, their own, dirtied the floor. A single bleary water glass sat on a dusty counter. An empty sink, empty shelves.
Sears chafed his cold hands together and came back out into the dark hallway. Now Don was banging the walls upstairs, looking for a secret panel, Sears imagined, and shook his head. That all three of them were still alive and prowling through the house proved to Sears that Eva had moved on and left nothing behind. He opened the door to the cellar. Wooden steps led down into complete blackness. Sears flicked the switch, and a bulb at the top of the steps went on. Its light revealed the steps and concrete floor at their bottom, but seemed to extend only 7 or 8 feet from the bottom of the steps. Apparently it was the only light, which meant, Sears realized, that the cellar was unused. The Robinsons had never turned the basement into a den or a family room. He went down a few steps and peered into the murk. What he could see looked like any Milburn cellar. Extending under the whole of the house about 7 feet high with walls of painted concrete block, the old furnace sat near the wall at the far end, casting a deep, many-armed shadow which met and melted smoothly into the gloom. On one side stood the tall tubular cylinder for hot water and 2 disconnected iron sinks. Sears heard a thump from upstairs, and his heart leaped. He was vastly more nervous than he wished to acknowledge. Tilting his head back toward the top of the stairs, he listened for further noises or sounds of distress, but heard none. Probably no more than a slamming door.
"Come down and play in the dark, Sears."
Sears took a step further down and saw his gigantic shadow advance along the concrete floor.
"Come on, Sears."
He did not hear the words spoken in his mind. He saw no images or pictures. But he had been commanded, and he followed his bloated shadow down onto the concrete floor.
"Come and see the toys I left for you."
He reached the concrete floor and experienced a sick thrill of pleasure that was not his own. Sears spun around, afraid that something was coming for him from under the wooden staircase. Light banded the concrete in stripes, streaming between the wood. Nothing was there. He would have to leave the protection of the light and look into the corners of the cellar. He moved forward, wishing wholeheartedly that he too had brought a knife, and his shadow melted away into the dark. Then all doubt left him.
"Oh, my God," he said.
John Jaffrey was stepping out into the shadowy light beside the furnace.
"Sears, old friend," he said. His voice was toneless. "Thank heavens you're here. They told me you would be, but I didn't know.
He shook his head.
"It's all been so confused."
"Stay away from me," Sears said.
"I saw Millie," John said. "And do you know, Millie just won't let me in the house. But I warned her. I told her to warn you and the others about something. Can't remember now."
He lifted his sunken face and twisted his mouth into a ghastly smile.
"I went over. Isn't that what Fenny said to you in your story? That's right. I went over, and now Millie won't open.
He raised his hand to his forehead.
"Oh, it's just awful, Sears. Can't you help me?"
Sears was backing away from him, unable to speak.
"Please. Funny. Here in this place again. They made me come here, wait for you. Please help me, Sears. Thank heavens you're here."
Jaffrey lurched into the light, and Sears saw fine gray dust covering his face and outstretched hands, his bare feet. Jaffrey was moving in a painful, senile circle, his eyes, too, seemingly covered by a mixture of dust and drying tears.
This spoke of more pain than his addled words and shuffling walk, and Sears, who remembered Peter Barnes's story about Lewis, at last felt more pity than fear.
"Yes, John," he said,
and Dr. Jaffrey, apparently unable to see in the light from the naked bulb, turned toward his voice. Sears went forward to touch Dr. Jaffrey's extended hand. At the last minute, he closed his eyes. A tingling sensation passed through his fingers and traveled halfway up his arm. When he opened his eyes, John was no longer there. He stumbled into the staircase, painfully bumping his ribs.
Toys.
Sears began mechanically to rub his hand against his coat. Would he have to find more creatures, shambling and dazed like John? But no, that was not what he would have to do. Sears soon discovered the reason for the plural noun. He walked out of the light toward the furnace and saw a heap of clothing dumped by the far wall, a pile of discarded boots and rags. It was eerily like the scrubby bodies of the sheep on Elmer Scales's farm. He wanted to turn away. All the truly bad things had begun back there, with him and Ricky freezing on a cold white hill. Sears saw a flaccid hand, a swirl of blonde hair. Then he recognized one of the rags as Christina Barnes's coat. It lay flat, nearly empty, flung over a second flattened and emptied body. And it enveloped a gray, deflated thing, ending in blonde hair, which was Christina's body. Instinctively, the shout escaping him, he called for the other two. Then Sears forced control on himself and went to the bottom of the stairs and began methodically, loudly, shamelessly to repeat their names. 6.
"So you three found them," Hardesty said. "You look pretty shook up, too."
Sears and Ricky were seated on a couch in John Jaffrey's house, Don in a chair immediately beside them. The sheriff, still wearing his coat and hat, was leaning against the mantel, trying to disguise the fact that he was very angry. The wet traces of his footprints on the carpet, a source of evident irritation to Millie Sheehan, until Hardesty had sent her out of the room, showed a circling path of firm heel prints and squared-off toes.
"So do you," Sears said. "Yeah, suppose I do. I never saw bodies like those two exactly. Even Freddy Robinson wasn't that bad. You ever seen bodies like that, Sears James, eh?" Sears shook his head. "No, you're damn right. Nobody ever did. And I'm going to have to storm up in the jail until the meat wagon can get in here. And I'm the poor son of a bitch who has to take Mrs. Hardy and Mr. Barnes along to see those goddamned things to identify them. Unless you'd like to do that for me, Mr. James."
"It's your job, Walt," Sears said.
"Shit. My job, is it? My job is finding out who did what to those people. And you two old buzzers just sit there, don't you? You found him by accident, I suppose. Just happened to break into that particular house. Just happened to be taking a walk on a goddamned day like this, I suppose. And just thought you'd try a little housebreaking. Jesus, I had to lock all three of you in the same cell with them. Along with the torn-up Louis Benedict and that nigger D'Souza and that Griffin boy who froze to death because his hippie mommy and daddy were too cheap to put a heater in his room. God damn, that's what I ought to do, all right."
Hardesty, now entirely unable to hide his anger, spat into the fireplace and kicked at the fender.
"Jesus, I'd live in that fucking jail. I really ought to haul you three assholes along and see how you like it."
"Walt," Sears said, "cool down."
"Sure. By God, if you two weren't nothing but a couple of 100-year-old lawyers with teeth in the palms of your hand, I'd do it."
"I mean, Walt," Sears calmly said, "if you will stop insulting us for a moment, that will tell you who killed Jim Hardy and Mrs. Barnes, and Lewis."
You will. Hot damn! Guess I don't have to get out the rubber hoses after all.
Silence for a moment. Then Hardesty said,
Well, I'm still here.
It was the woman who calls herself Anna Mostyn.
Swell! Just dandy! Okay, Anna Mostyn. Okay. It was her house, so she's the one. Good work! Now, what did she do? Suck 'em dry like a hound'll do to an egg? And who held 'em down? Because I know no woman could have taken that crazy Hardy kid by herself, huh?
She did have help, Sear said. It was a man who calls himself Gregory Bate or Benton. Now hold on to yourself, Walt, because here comes the difficult part. Bate has been dead for almost 50 years, and Anna Mostyn... He stopped. Hardesty had clamped both eyes shut. Ricky took it up.
Sheriff, in a way, you were right about all this from the beginning. Remember when we looked at Elmer Scales's sheep, and you told us about other incidents, lots of them, that happened in the 60s?
Hardesty's bloodshot eyes flew open.
It's the same thing, Ricky said. That is, we think it's probably the same thing. But here, they're out to kill people.
So, what's this Anna Mostyn? Hardesty asked, his body rigid. A ghost? A vampire?
Something like that, Sears said. A shapeshifter, but those words will do.
Where is she now?
That's why we went to her house, to see if we could find anything.
And that's what you're going to tell me. Nothing more.
There is no more, Sears said.
I wonder if anyone can lie like a 100-year-old lawyer, Hardesty said, and spat once more into the fire.
Okay. Now, let me tell you something. I'm going to put out a bulletin on this Anna Mostyn, and that's all she wrote. That's all I'm going to do. You two old buzzards and this kid here can spend the rest of the winter ghost hunting for all I'm concerned. You're screwball. As far as I'm concerned, you're plumb out of your heads. And if I get some goddamned killer who drinks beer and eats hamburgers and takes his kid out for a drive on Sundays, then I'm going to call you up and laugh in your faces. And I'll see that people around here never stop laughing when they hear your names. You understand me?
Don't shout at us, Walt, Sears said. I'm sure we all understand what you said. And we understand one thing more.
Just what the hell is that?
That you're frightened, Sheriff. But you have a lot of company.
Conversation with G. 7.
Are you really a sailor, G?
Did you go a lot of places?
Yes.
How come you can hang around Milburn so long? Don't you have a ship to get back to?
Shore leave.
Why don't you ever want to do anything but go to the movies?
No reason.
Well, I just like being with you. But why don't you ever take off your shades?
No reason.
Someday I'll take them off.
Later.
Promise?
Promise.
Conversation with Stella. 8.
Ricky, what's happening to us? What's happening to Milburn?
A terrible thing. I don't want to tell you now. There'll be time when it's all over.
You're frightening me.
I'm frightened, too.
Well, I'm frightened because you're frightened.
For a time, the Hawthorns simply held each other.
You know what killed Lewis, don't you?
I think so.
Well,
I discovered an astonishing thing about myself. I can be a coward. So please, don't tell me. I know I asked, but don't. I just want to know it'll end. Sears and I will make it end, with young Wanderley's help. He can help you? He can. He has already. If only this terrible snow would stop. Yes, but it won't. Ricky, have I given you an awful time?
Stella propped herself up on an elbow to look into his eyes.
A worse time than most women would, he said. But I rarely wanted any other woman. I am sorry that I ever had to cause you pain. Ricky, I've never cared for any man as much as I have cared for you, despite my adventures. You know that's all over, don't you?
I guessed.
He was an appalling man. He was in my car, and I just overwhelmingly realized how much better than he you were. So I made him get out.
Stella smiled.
He shouted at me. It seems I am a bitch.
At times you certainly are.
At times. You know, he must have found Lewis's body right after that.
Ah, I wondered what he was doing up there. Silence. Ricky held his wife's shoulder, aware of her timeless profile beside him. If she had not looked like that, could he have endured it so long? Yet, if she had not looked like that, she would not have been Stella. It was an impossible speculation.
Tell me something, baby, she breathed. Who was this other woman you used to want?
Ricky laughed. Then both of them, at least for a time, were laughing. 9. Motionless days. Milburn lay frozen under the accumulating snow. Garage owners took their telephones off their hooks, knowing they already had too much snowplow business with their regular customers. Omar Norris carried a bottle in each of his coat's deep pockets and rammed the city's plow into twice his usual quota of parked cars. He was on triple time, often plowing the same streets 2 or 3 times a day, and sometimes when he got back to the municipal garage, Omar was so drunk that he simply rolled onto a cot in the foreman's office instead of going home. Copies of The Urbanite stood in wrapped bundles in the back of the print room. The newsboys couldn't get to their collection points. Finally, Ned Rolls shut the paper down for a week and sent everybody home with a Christmas bonus.
In this weather, he told his staff, nothing's going to happen except more of this weather. Have yourselves a merry little Christmas.
But even in an immobilized town, things happen. Dozens of cars went off the roads and stayed nose down for days, buried under fresh drifts. Walter Barnes sat in his television room, nursing a succession of drinks, and watched an endless round of giveaway shows with the sound turned off. Peter cooked their meals.
I could understand a lot of things, Barnes told his son, but I sure as hell can't understand that.
And went back to his quiet, non-stop drinking. One Friday night, Clark Mulligan put the first reel of Night of the Living Dead back in the projector for the Saturday noon showing, turned off all the lights, flipped the broken lock on the fire door, and decided once again not to bother with it and went back out into the blizzard to find Penny Drager's body lying half-covered with snow beside an abandoned car. He slapped her face and rubbed her wrists, but nothing he could do would put breath back in her throat or change the expression on her face. G, had finally allowed her to take off his dark glasses. And Elmer Scales finally met the man from Mars. 10. It happened on the day before Christmas. The date meant nothing to Elmer. For weeks he had done his chores in a blind rage of impatience, cuffing his children if they came too close, and leaving the Christmas arrangements to his wife. She had bought the presents and put up the tree, having given up on Elmer until he realized that what he was waiting up for every night didn't exist and never would wait around to get shot. On Christmas Eve, Mrs. Scales and the children went to bed early, leaving Elmer sitting with the shotgun across his lap and his paper and pencil on the table to his right. Elmer's chair faced his picture window, and with the lights off, he could see about as far as the barn, a big shape in the darkness. Except for where he had shoveled, the snow was waist high, enough to slow down any sort of creature who was after more of his animals. Elmer did not need light to scribble down the random lines he thought of. By now, he did not even have to look at the paper. He could write while staring out the window. "Summers them old trees was high enough to glide from," and "Lord, Lord, farmin's a ball-breakin' business," and "Somethin's not a squirrel scratchin' under the eaves." Lines he knew would come to nothing, were not poetry, were nonsense, but which he had to write down anyhow because they came into his mind. At times they were joined by other lines, part of a conversation someone was having with his father, and these fragments too he wrote down. "Warren, can we borrow your automobile? We promised to bring it back real soon. Real soon. Got urgent business." Sometimes it seemed his father was there in the dark room with him, trying to explain something about the old plow horses he'd finally replaced with a John Deere, trying to say that those were good horses. "You got to take care for them, boy. They done good by us. Those five kids you got could get a lot of pleasure out of nice old horses like that. Horses dead for 25 years. Trying to tell him something about the car. "Watch them two lawyer boys, honey. Banged up my car and lost it. Drove it into a swamp or something. Gave me cash dollars, but nobody can trust boys like that, no matter how rich they daddies are." Creaky old voice, getting at him just like when the old man was alive. Elmer wrote it all down, getting it mixed up with the poetry that wasn't poetry. Then he saw a shape gliding toward the window, coming toward him through the snow and night with shining eyes. Elmer dropped the pencil and jerked up the shotgun, nearly firing both barrels through the picture window, before he realized that the creature was not running away, that it knew he was there and was coming for him. Elmer kicked away the chair and stood up. He patted his pockets to make sure he was carrying the extra shells, and then lifted the shotgun and sighted down the barrel, waiting for the thing to get close enough for him to see what it really was. As it advanced, he began to doubt. If it knew he was there, waiting to blast it all the way back to the barn, why wasn't it running away? He cocked the hammers. The thing was coming up his walk, going between the two big drifts, and Elmer finally saw that it was much shorter than what he had seen before. Then it left the walk and came over the snow to press its face against the window, and he saw that it was a child. Elmer lowered the gun, numb with confusion. He could not shoot a child. The face at the window peered in at him with a frantic, lost appeal. It was the face of misery, of every human wretchedness. With those yellow eyes, it begged him to come out, to give it rescue. Elmer moved to the door, hearing his father's voice behind him. He paused with his hand on the doorknob, the shotgun dangling from his other hand, and then opened the door. Freezing air, powdery snow blew in his face. The child was standing on the walk with its head averted. Someone said, "Thank you, Mr. Scales." Elmer jerked his head back and saw the tall man standing on the snowdrift to his left. Way up there, balancing on the snow like a feather, he was smiling gently down at the farmer. His face was ivory, and his eyes were vibrant accumulations of, it seemed to Elmer, 100 shades of gold. He was the most beautiful man Elmer had ever seen, and Elmer knew that he could not shoot him if he stood in front of him for a decade with a loaded and cocked shotgun.
"You, why,
Elmer managed to say. "Precisely, Mr. Scales," the beautiful man said, and effortlessly stepped down from the snowbank onto the path. When he was facing Elmer, the golden eyes seemed to shimmer with wisdom.
"You're no Martian," Elmer said.
He did not even feel the cold anymore.
"Why, of course not. I'm part of you, Elmer. You can see that, can't you?"
Elmer nodded dumbly. The beautiful thing put a hand on Elmer's shoulder.
"I'm here to talk to you about your family. You'd like to come with us, wouldn't you, Elmer?"
Elmer nodded again.
"Then there are a few details you have to take care of. At the moment, you're slightly encumbered. You cannot imagine the harm done to you by the people around you, Elmer. I am afraid there are things about them you have to know."
"Tell me,"
Elmer said.
"With pleasure. And then you will know what to do?"
Elmer blinked. 11. Some hours later on Christmas Eve, Walt Hardesty woke up in his office and noticed that the brim of his Stetson bore a new stain. He had knocked over a glass while sleeping at his desk, and the small amount of bourbon remaining in the glass had soaked into his hat. "Assholes," he pronounced, meaning the deputies, then remembered that the deputies had gone home hours before and would not return for 2 days. He uprighted the glass and blinked around him. The light in his untidy office hurt his eyes, but seemed oddly pale, dim, and somehow pinkish, as if on some early morning of a Kansas spring 40 years before. Hardesty coughed and rubbed his eyes, feeling a little like that bozo in the old story who went to sleep one day and woke up with white hair and a long beard, about 100 years older.
"Rip Van Shitstorm," he muttered,
and worked for a while at clearing the phlegm from his throat. After that he tried to blot the hat brim on his shirt sleeve, but the stain, though still damp, had set. He lifted the hat to his nose. County Fair.
"Well, what the hell," he thought, and sucked at the coffee-colored stain.
Lint, dust, a faint trace of bourbon came into his mouth, along with a disagreeable flavor of wet felt. Hardesty went to the sink in his office, rinsed out his mouth, and bent down to look into the mirror. There was Rip Van Shitstorm indeed, the famous hat sucker, a sight which gave him no pleasure, and he was about to turn away when he finally recorded that behind him and to his left, just visible over his shoulder, the door to the utility cells was open wide. And that was impossible. He unlocked that door only when Leon Churchill or some other